Hi, thank you. Yes, I'm Mary Lusk, and I am from University of Florida IFAS Extension, and I'm excited to be able to talk to you today about optimizing the hydrologic properties of urban soils. So step one, remove the concrete, and then you've done a lot to improve those hydrologic properties right there. But it's not that easy, so let's talk a little bit more about some of our other options. Just as an overview for my objectives today, I'd like to just review the range of values for soil hydrologic properties in undeveloped or undisturbed soils, because I thought, you know, it makes a lot of sense if we're going to be talking about how to optimize the hydrologic properties of soils, then we perhaps first ought to just define what some of those target optimal values are. So I'll go over that just briefly, and then describe briefly how urbanization affects the hydrologic properties of soils, and then give some examples of actions that we can do to optimize the hydrologic properties of our urban soils. And a lot of those we've seen already in this symposium today, so I'm really grateful for all of the great examples we've had so far, because they add to and really complement what I've got for you as well. So in any type of landscape, soil-water relationships are absolutely critical. They are so important, because those soil-water relationships, as you know, determine so many things. They determine those ecosystem services in many ways, like we just talked about, how water and nutrient get to the roots of our plants and our trees. Through the soil, erosion and runoff and groundwater recharge, all of those things. I've got a picture here of a blue dye test. I had a great opportunity a few weeks ago. I was talking with a watermelon grower up in the Suwannee River watershed area of Florida, and we had a wonderful opportunity to do a blue dye test for this guy and to show him how water was moving in his fields under his watermelon crops, and to convince him that he could implement some really water-conserving irrigation practices. Once he saw the evidence of the blue dye and how that water was moving through his soil, he became convinced, I can do things to conserve my water a little bit. His mantra now is, the blue dye don't lie. And it was really exciting for him to see this in action. And it's really exciting for me as well to be able to be involved in that. And that was an ag example. But this same thing applies in our urban ecosystems as well. Being able to understand what's going on with the water movement in those soils is just so important, and it's so good to know what's going on. And it helps us to improve our ecosystem services and functionings of these soils when we know what's going on. So just to kind of give you a little bit of background of sort of what is optimal, if we're going to optimize our hydrologic properties, what are we shooting for? So think back to when you were in Soils 101 and you were reading the Brady text, and I think we've all seen it. There's the pie chart of a mineral soil, and it's about 45% solids and about 5% organic matter, and the rest of that in the ideal mineral soil is voids, right? Air and water, pore space, essentially. So in our ideal mineral soils, we're typically shooting for about 40 to 60% porosity. About 50% is an average value given a lot of times. Porosity is not the only thing that's important. We've also got to think about pore size. So we have very small pores, we have larger pores, we have those micropores, very important for holding water against gravity. We have those macropores, the larger ones, that become very important for root movement and diffusion of gases through the soil. We also have bulk density that we just cannot leave out of this discussion. Bulk density in and of itself is not a hydrologic property of soils, but it affects the hydrologic property of soils, so we can't leave it out. Those values ranging from about 1.1 to 1.6, depending on the texture of your soil. We also have infiltration rate, a very important property of the soils and very important ability of these soils is to infiltrate that precipitation or irrigation water, whatever it may be, that's coming in contact with that soil surface. That's going to vary a lot by texture, but it's something that also is really affected by management practices. So we can get things like a surface crust. If we have irrigation water that's dispersing those soil particles and breaking up the aggregates, we can get the surface crusting going on. Or we can just put impervious cover over it, obviously, which is going to really affect that infiltration rate. So it's something there that's really affected by management practices. A couple other properties that just to mention briefly, you know, aggregation and soil structure is so important for hydrologic movements in soil, so important for that we maintain those stable aggregates and have that well-defined soil structure so we can get that interconnectivity in the soil so we can really get good movement of things going on. And permeability as well, just that intrinsic property of the soil to be able to have that connectivity of pores and be able to transmit fluids. And we can't leave out organic matter. We've talked about organic matter quite a bit already today, but so important. Our mineral soils, you know, typically only have about 2 to 10% of their volume is occupied by organic matter, but that small amount of organic matter is so important. And there's a study that was done many years ago, but it's an important study because it kind of changed our way of thinking about soil organic matter. And this was Hudson back in 94, who found that if we go from 0.5% to as much as just 3% soil organic matter, that we double our available water capacity in our soils. And just really pointing out that importance of maintaining soil organic matter. And that's something that we lose very quickly, or can lose very quickly through urbanization. And a lot of this has to do with that ability that the organic matter has to bind those aggregates together. So I've got this picture here of the little soil aggregates, and the little soil aggregates, and this binding sort of glue that develops between them from our soil organic matter, from microbial exudates and byproducts of the decomposition process. So very important for us. So let's look at some things that can happen to our urban soils. We've got one thing that can happen here is surface crusting. So think about irrigation water that's hitting that surface soil and dispersing the particles, things like that. And this really affects the infiltration rate of these soils. We have a lot of opportunities, a lot of instances where we're just removing that soil, and then we're stockpiling it, and it sits there, and then we mix it with something, and then we bring it back, and we put it back to the site somehow. So all of this is going on. We've got fill material that gets incorporated into the soil. So I don't know what you call that horizon down there on the bottom, but that is not natural. So we've got this whole sort of thing going on. And you know, we also just have traffic, vehicle traffic, equipment traffic, or just people in the city park walking on these soils. So we get compaction and those sorts of things going on. So with those sorts of things going on in our urban soils, I wanted to ask you to just tell me for a minute what kind of differences you would expect for soil water movement comparing a natural soil versus an urban soil or soil that's been affected by urbanization. Just throw out some things that are going to that you would expect.
Different.
Yeah, so you're going to get pooling and perching of water on that surface because of reduced infiltration, reduced permeability, compaction, higher bulk density, definitely. So once you have that, and you have more runoff and all of the nutrients and the sediments and pathogens that go with it. What else? Reduced permeable surface, so we're just not getting that flow into the water to start with.
Reduced uptake by
plants. If it doesn't get to that root zone, it's not being taken up by that plant. Yeah. So a lot of these things going on, all of these problematics. So when we look at how urbanization can affect the hydrologic properties of soils, and this is just a very generalized sort of table, but you see all of these properties over here on the left, and the general response of these properties to urbanization, and all of these are things that essentially de-optimize the ability of water to move through those soils and to do what we need that water to do. So we're getting higher bulk density and higher compaction. We're decreasing our aggregation and porosity and our number of macropores. We're getting slower infiltration, and that's going to decrease our available water content. So we end up with things like this. So on the left, we have the sad little urban tree with this little box of soil that it gets. And that little urban tree, you know, it's sitting in that soil. It's probably compacted and has all of these loss of structure and things like that, loss of organic matter. And then on the right, we get this runoff that can happen. So these are some things that can happen once we get to that point in our urban soils. So I wanted to focus on for the next few minutes with some fixes, some things that we can do to fix these problems, to avoid them in the first place, or to come in and remediate those problems. And the first thing that we can do is just have better site design and better site planning and careful construction practices. And so even though we do that wonderfully well many times, sometimes though we just still have to go back and do post-construction amendments or physical alterations. So I'll talk about some of those as well. Okay, so the first of these that I wanted to mention was just a low-impact development, or LID, and cluster development. Low-impact development, of course, just being where we maintain a lot of natural features on that site, where we bring in elements like bioswales, rain gardens, those types of things. cluster development being here, where we take all that, take the housing in this neighborhood, we cluster it and we really centralize it so that it's in a very centralized portion, and we leave a lot of open land around that. And this is a great opportunity to protect and to build our soil organic matter, to minimize disturbance, keep soil structure good so we can intercept and store stormwater. And here's some data from that. So this is a case study from some work that was done in Massachusetts. And so just pay attention here. The purple bars are the pre-development watershed. So water runoff that's coming from this watershed pre-development. And the green bars are conventional development. So what we typically do in a conventional residential neighborhood. Pink or red bars are a cluster development only, and the blue bars here are represent cluster development plus augmented with LID. And you see that the cluster development reduced runoff by 35%, and the cluster plus LID reduced a little bit more, reduced that runoff by 38%. And a really important lesson, a take-home message from this research that was done in Massachusetts was the LID maintenance was crucial. So when they went in and developed this LID neighborhood, they put in some swales and rain gardens and those kinds of things, but over time they weren't maintained. And they ended up not doing anything, and they had to go back a couple years later and take all of those out. So a really take-home message is if we're going to have these elements put out there into our communities, then we've got to have parties responsible for maintaining them. We've got to remember to maintain them. Another take-home message that was really crucial for this was construction oversight. So the engineers on this site had had a recipe for good soil to go into like the rain gardens and the swales. But then the construction company that came back later and actually put that soil in, you know, dirt was dirt to them. And so they didn't follow that recipe and they didn't put in the soil texture that had been specified by the engineering design. And it didn't do much good in that case. So some lessons learned there. Maintain your LID features and really make sure that you have that construction oversight so that the soil you need is what's really going in there. This is another data. This is from some work done in California, a study by Hood and his colleagues in 2009. And I really just wanted to point out here the effect of this, the effect of runoff threshold here. So this is going to be the storm depth at which runoff begins. And in the traditional neighborhood, it starts, you know, right around about somewhere around two millimeters, yeah. But that goes up to about five or six for the LID neighborhood. So we were able to contain the runoff from these smaller storms at a much greater proportion in this LID neighborhood. And that's important because we get a lot of these really small sort of storms that can produce a runoff just a little bit, and this LID neighborhood doing a very good job of containing that in comparison to the traditional neighborhood. Another thing that we can do is just incorporate native vegetation into our urban landscapes. So this is a study that was done just recently by Johnston and their colleagues in 2016, looking at some native prairie gardens in place of lawn turf. And you see there just this list of greater hydrologic properties that were underneath the soils of these prairies. Are prairie plantings as opposed to just plain old turf grass. And then most of this is due to just the greater biomass underground, that root activity, and getting greater aggregation and soil structure. With careful construction, we can minimize, we're not going to prevent it entirely ever, but we can minimize compaction of our urban soils. So we can do things like have no disturb zones, or we can add a mulch layer to our construction sites, have mulch paths for our construction equipment. So the recommendation is usually to have about a 20-inch mulch layer. It could be a bark mulch that the heavy equipment can go over, and that will really minimize the compaction from that heavy equipment. Again, you're not going to avoid it completely, but you can minimize that if you keep it to these certain paths. All right, so sometimes, though, even with all your best planning, you still cannot avoid having some of the problems that we see. So sometimes you just have to go in and do some physical alterations to these sites. Soil replacement or tillage can be an example of that. This is going to be quite expensive and intensive. It's going to be a lot of work. But it's something that we can do. So it's usually, you know, just involves taking that soil out and bringing something better in. And I guess you better make sure that whatever you're bringing back in is really better. You got to make sure of that. But it can be done. You got to be careful. You can have buried utility lines in urban environments, so be careful of that. Some tillage options here, you know, we can go really deep, 60 to 90 centimeters, or if we are concerned about buried utility lines, we can do more shallow tillage in the top 15 centimeters. For trees, this is a good one. We can do the air tilling, which just involves shooting pressurized air into that soil to help break it up and loosen up a little bit, get a lower bulk density in there, and it will not hurt the tree roots like your tilling will. Or we can also just do plug aeration if you have an existing landscape already in place and you want to minimize disturbance to that existing landscape. Remember this guy? We've got this guy again. We've seen this guy before today. He's really famous today. So So compost is obviously another alternative that we can use to improve our hydrologic properties. And we've talked about this today already, a wonderful example, and this is probably the most studied of all of the methods of being able to improve soil water movement in urban soils. And it's also our least expensive and our least intensive. It's really great for already established sites. We can use biosolids, we can use yard waste compost, we can use manures. So you bring it in once or twice a year, a 2 to 5 centimeter compost incorporated into the top of that soil. Just remember to watch the C-N ratio on it, because if it's too high, you can get nitrogen immobilization. Just pointing out some studies that have been done on composting in urban soils. You see all these positives, showing ways that we've had positive influences on the properties of soil that will optimize hydrologic properties. This is a really interesting study. This is very similar to the one that I think that Susan was describing, very similar. So this was a park in Minneapolis, and the researchers, it was a very compacted site, and so they went in and had a control plot. They also had a plot that they just tilled, and they had a third plot they tilled and added compost. And you can see, comparison to the control, pre-remediation and post-remediation 2 years later, increases in hydraulic connectivity of these soils. You know, a lot more blues and greens over here as opposed to the reds and oranges and yellows over here, which indicates an increase in hydraulic connectivity. So really sending home the message of how really the benefits that we can get from tillage and then tillage plus compost, you get even a little bit more benefit. Similar site in New York City. This was a site done in Queens in New York City, prepping the site for urban forestry. In this site, these are all tree species, so different tree species, but nested within this experimental design of different tree species, they also had composted versus non-composted. And 2 years later, the composted sites, had a little bit better, performing a little bit better, more microbial biomass, reduced bulk density, a little bit greater water holding capacity. So again, just showing the value of compost and preparing these sites for urban forestry. Finally, engineered soils. We've talked about these a little bit already today, so I won't focus on them a lot. But one of the big take-home message is not only do we need these soils to support plants and sort of other ecosystem services in the urban environment, we also need them to be structurally sound. They need to support the urban infrastructure. And those needs can sometimes be at odds with each other, as we've discussed already today. So we have engineered structural soils that can be penetrable for tree roots, but yet also still meet load-bearing requirements of the urban environment. And again, here's just an example. This is an engineered soil used in Florida. It is 80% crushed stone, about 1-inch diameter little pieces, and then about 20% loam or clay loam soil mixed in with that. It also has a polymer sort of hydrogel that aids in mixing that and helps us to get stone-to-stone contact. And that stone-to-stone contact is important because that's where you get your load-bearing capacity. So those sort of angular stones are able to touch each other, and they transfer the load, and that's where we get that load-bearing capacity. And we've talked about these as well. So sometimes the structural soils may, there's some limitations there as far as water and nutrient holding capacity sometimes. And another alternative is that we can look at structural cells, a couple of proprietary brands of this out, such as the Silva cell. So in contrast to the structural soils, these have about 90% void space. They're just these pillars that give the structural stability, but then they're void in here, and we can fill those with the native soil or some other preferred soil, and we get a lot more soil volume. And this may be really good, a good choice when we also need pollutant removal. So if we have the need for those soils to filter out pollutants as well, because this will give a lot of contact with that pollutant with the soil and give chances for pollutant retention. Okay, so just to wrap it up, you know, urbanization, as we know we've talked about today, can reduce the ideal functioning of soil-water relationships because of these things like compaction and loss of soil organic matter, with loss of structure and aggregation, surface crusting, just plain old impervious surfaces. It's best if we can prevent that in the first place through careful design. It not always can happen, so we can go in and do some post-construction alternatives like replacement or tillage or composting or using our engineered or our structural soils. And I'm really glad to hear that there's some more research being done on the engineered soils. I think that's exciting. It's something that we need more research on. As I prepared this, I realized that there are a lot of gaps in this research. We need a lot of work done on ways that we can look at water properties in these urban soils, because I want urban stakeholders to also be able to say, the blue dye don't lie. I want people to be able to really start thinking about water movement in these urban soils and be excited about it. And we need more research on that. All right, so that's it, and thank you for your time today.
Do we have time for a few questions? Questions for Mary?
Can you elaborate on your comment about using the LID maintenance? What kinds of activities would be important to do?
Yeah, so sometimes it's going to be important to go into like a swale and remove sediments. From time to time, that's going to need to be done. They can get sedimented up a lot, so going back in and removing those sediments. Also, just making sure the plants stay alive. If they don't, they're not doing much good as far as taking up stormwater or those sorts of things. So that can be important. Yeah.
Portland is one of the cities that's gone very heavily into bioretention systems and green infrastructure, and there are big issues with the utilities because the utility needs people now to weed and to add compost, and that's not a traditional thing that the utility would do. So is the utility allowed to do something like that? So you get into all these really interesting complications. Yeah. That it's like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, it seems so simple. You know,
yes.
We just say, oh, put in LID.
But
so simple.
Maintenance can be
an issue. Yep.
Because it's not within the traditional
process. Yeah, who does it? Who's responsible for it? Who pays for it?
Yes.
Yeah.